There's a basic subject that we haven't really discussed before, which is really can't understand a Torah approach to life without some way of knowing how to handle this issue. So let's see if we can, apart from something that we're due to talk about on Chanukah next week, it's the last time that we're due to meet for the next few months, except for that. Let's try and understand this subject, which is very basic, and it is the root of the idea of how a person relates to the spiritual world while they're in the physical world. In other words, there's a classic subject that's known as Hishtadlus and Bitachon. That's usually the way it's referred to, meaning there's an obligation to make an effort. That means you live in a physical world, environment, let's say the real world, let's say, physical terms, and you have to make an effort. You can't sit immobile expecting things to happen for you. You have to make an effort. On the other hand, you're supposed to conduct yourself in such a way that you understand that Hashem is doing everything that's being done. And the two, of course, are a contradiction to each other. When you make an effort, when a person makes an effort in the world, so then you have what looks like the result of his effort. That means if you go out to make a living. So because you spend time trying to make a living, and then you make a living, of course the natural tendency is to say that you earn this money because you put the work in. And not to say that Hashem gave you this money and would have given it to you otherwise. Would have given it to you anyway. On the other hand, would he really have given it to you anyway if you would have stayed home? How does that work exactly? We understand that on Rosh Hashanah, how much you're going to earn in the coming year is actually predestined in some sense. On the other hand, we are required to go out and make an effort. So there's a paradox here, there's a conflict between how much effort you have to make, and yet you also have to be aware all the time that the effort's actually irrelevant. It means you have to be sort of schizophrenic. You have to know that you're making an effort. At the same time, no matter how much effort you make, you have to be aware that your effort actually is irrelevant, that the consequences are happening in the spiritual world regardless of your effort. Now, how exactly do you approach this paradox? At which level, how does a person conduct himself, especially, let's say, if you're starting out in spiritual, personally starting out in spiritual growth? How do you handle this issue? Do you have to do more in the physical world? Do you have to do less? How do you find the balance, exactly what it is you're supposed to do in the physical world? How do you appreciate, if you're busy doing physical activity, how do you appreciate the spiritual source of things? Now, if you do make an effort in the physical world, even a token effort, but then you find that it's possible to say that the result happened because you made an effort. So that clouds your eyes from seeing that the result actually happens from the spiritual world. On the other hand, if you don't make an effort, then you're not allowed to see the results. Hashem doesn't give you the consequences, doesn't give you what you need if you don't make any effort at all. So it seems that you're caught either way. This is the classic problem, the classic paradox that's called Hishtadlus and Bitachon. Hishtadlus means the effort that you have to make, the work you have to put in, not the token effort or the effort, physical effort you have to put in the physical world. Bitachon means in English it's called, let's say, faith, or in Emunah is really faith. Bitachon means trust in Hashem, let's say. They usually translate it as trust. Trust in Hashem. That's not a good translation. But it means knowing that everything comes from the spiritual dimension, from Hashem. And the tension between these two is a classic Torah subject that is not easy to understand. At a simple level, a person can train himself to do certain things. The example that comes to mind is the Rambam composed a small prayer, small tefillah, that a person should say before Rambam was a doctor. So before taking any medication, or for that matter, for a doctor, when a doctor gives any medication, then he composed a little tefillah that a person should say. It's very interesting. What are the words? The words are, Yehi Ratzon Milfonecho, may it be your will, Hashem, Eisek ze li refuah. May this thing, Eisek means whatever this thing is, this tablet or this injection or whatever it is, may this medicine, let's say, be a healing for me. What do you achieve by doing this? You achieve the following thing. You're first of all taking the medicine. The Rambam doesn't say over there that you should avoid medicines and just sit and meditate or daven. He doesn't say that. You take the medicine. But because of the danger of taking the medication and thinking that maybe the medicine helped you, and losing sight of the spiritual world, which is the worst thing you could do, so what you do is you make the effort, which you're obliged to, but in order not to hide from yourself the spiritual source, so you reinforce the message. You say to yourself, Hashem, I know it's you who are doing this. effect that's going to be brought about now, and I'm only taking the medicine as a token effort because you require it. May it be your will that the medicine will do what it's supposed to do, but may it be your will, no? You're not saying to Hashem that the medicine should work and he should stay out of the picture, Chas v'Shalom. What you're saying is, may it be your will. In other words, the only things that happen in the world actually are your will. And therefore, what you do is, you ask that his rotzin, his will, no, divine energy, should be put into this activity that you're doing, and that's actually what should make it work. In other words, you're trying to deal with the problem of having to make a physical effort and not forget, not become drawn into the physical world and think that it's real. Can't ignore it, and you can't let it override. They say very sharply that a doctor has to function extremely in extreme fashion in this regard. Actually, everybody does, but the example is very clear in medicine, is that when a doctor treats his patient, the way he has to treat the patient is, he has to, before he starts treating the patient, he has to say to himself that what's going to happen to this patient has got nothing to do with me. In other words, whether this patient lives or dies, it's got nothing to do with my effort. It's all up to Hashem. He's got his own cheshbon and shemaim. What's going to happen to him has got nothing to do with me. If Hashem has destined or wants this patient to live, then no matter what I do, no matter how great my skill, if Hashem wants him to live, no matter how much I try the opposite, I'm not going to harm him, and vice versa. If he's not able to make it, then no matter how great my skill, I won't be able to help him. And after he's reinforced that idea and he's got it clear to himself, he then has to start treating the patient as if the patient's every breath depends on him. In other words, he has to make an effort as if it depends on him. But with every effort that he makes that takes full responsibility, you're not allowed to be slipshod and say, well, it doesn't make any difference. Actually, it's only a token effort anyway. So why bother to do it properly? You're not allowed to do that. You have to make the effort in a responsible fashion, but never be drawn into the trap of thinking that your effort actually is achieving the result, which is a very, very difficult thing to do. That's a schizophrenic sort of exercise that a person has to train himself to do. And actually, a person who earns a living has to do the same thing, also has to tell himself or herself that the effort is actually only what's required technically, but is not actually achieving the result. But there's a deeper way that this problem can be understood, which is based on this idea. Let's see if we can try and work through it and understand. Now, a Miller from Gateshead expresses it something like this. Talmud of the great Rabbi Dessler puts across the idea in the following form. He basically divides people into five different levels. And two years ago, we discussed the four different levels, or the different levels, on which people can be in terms of their connection to the spiritual world. That means how a person sees nature and how a person sees miracle. What's called nais. Nais and teva. How do you see the spiritual world? How do you look at the miraculous? And how do you look at the natural? Do you see the distinction between the two? Do you see nature as miracle? There are four levels on which people can be. We won't have time now to work through all those levels and tonight's idea, but the two have to be seen together. If you're interested in the subject, particularly, then you can... I think there's a cassette that was made of that discussion. I think it's called Nature and Miracles, if I'm not mistaken. Or it's called the Four Levels of Nature. I forget exactly the name, but it goes through the levels on which people can be in terms of how well they see the spiritual world. Now, and that will give background that will fill out this evening's discussion. We'll have occasion to refer to some of those levels. You can look at people in terms of being on different spiritual levels. And you will understand from this distinction, this way of dividing people's spiritual level, let's say spiritual greatness, you can understand from this exactly why it is that some people have to do a lot of effort in the physical world. Some people do not have to do a lot of effort. Some people may not do a lot of effort. Some people have to do a lot of effort and fail. Other people have to do a lot of effort and succeed. And Hashem deals with each person not according to his need. In other words, what we hope to achieve from this discussion is a beginning of an understanding of the very confusing idea of why it may be that I may put a lot of effort into something and fail completely. And somebody else may put effort in and succeed. And somebody else may put very little effort in and succeed very greatly. Why does Hashem do that? Now, that's a very important subject. And from an understanding of this subject, a person can learn how much effort it is that they're supposed to be making. Because it would be very tragic to spend your life making an effort in the physical world when actually it's not required from you. A person goes to work every day. Actually, at the beginning of the year, it's been defined how much you'll earn this year. And if you make a tiny amount of effort, 1 hour a month, all you have to do is buy a lottery ticket. There were great tzaddikim of the last generation who used to do that. It's an effort. Somebody wins. That's an effort. That's how they used to earn a living. I don't know if any of them ever won. But They understood that Hashem requires an effort. They wanted to sit and learn Torah all day. So why not sit and learn all day? Are you required to make a token effort? Go out, spend 10 minutes, buy a lottery ticket, you made your effort. Making an effort to earn a living is a tax that you have to pay. Adam was created, Adam Rishon was created without having to make an effort. He was created in a garden, an amazing spiritual, mystical place. He didn't have to make any effort. Because of the sin, he was cursed with the obligation and the requirement to make some kind of effort. It was like a tax was imposed on his life. But as all the commentaries say, when you're given a tax, you don't try to pay more. When you're taxed, you try to get away with the least that you have to. And therefore, when a person's taxed and has to make an effort in making a living, get away with the least. Sit and learn Torah all day. Put yourself into situations where you'll grow spiritually. Not spend your time working on yourself, learning Torah, learning Musa, doing mitzvahs. And tokenism. So an hour a week, an hour a day, an hour a week, an hour a month, whatever it is. It would be nice to be able to do that, right? No? Why not? No, and according to Torah philosophy, that's what one has to do. One has to come close as possible to the line. What's the minimum amount of effort? Or what's, let's say, the maximum effort that I'm allowed to make, or the minimum that I must make in order to deserve, in order to earn what it is that I hope to earn here. Now, there are many principles that apply to this very complex question, but one of them, just one dimension of this issue, which gives tremendous clarity at many different levels of reality, is what he puts across as follows. Again, I'm not claiming that it explains the whole overall picture. You need many other angles also that fill it in. And of course, each person has to assess it in his own individual, personal, private situation in terms of exactly what he or she needs now. But the overall guidelines, a wonderful approach to the subject, beginning approach to the subject, is something like this. First of all, you see people. There are people, we don't see them today, but you have at the highest level of reality, people who are so spiritually accomplished, people who have reached such a high level of spiritual awareness, of self-development, of consciousness of Hashem, let's say, that people in this level make no distinction between nature and miracle. That's what has to be understood first and foremost. Again, it's not relevant to most of us. If you think it's relevant to you, if you think you're on a level where miracles, yeah, where you can perform miracles, as these people can on this level, then you don't belong here in this conversation. But if you feel you're a bit below that, maybe, just a little bit below that level, then you might gain something from this discussion. So let's understand. You have people on a level, or we certainly have in Jewish history, people who are on a level where they can perform miracles, let's say. Right? They merit seeing the miraculous. They merit seeing the supernatural transcendent phenomena happen. Why? Why? Let's understand. The question we wish to get to, let's make it clear, the question we wish to get to is, why do they have to make any effort in the physical world? If you're on such a level that the miraculous happens for you, you need something and it happens, so why do you have to make an effort to achieve that which you need? If you're able to call on a miracle any time you want, and we have many, many examples in Torah and in Jewish history, so why do you have to make an effort? That's the question. But let's approach it like this. First of all, you have people on that level. Examples would be, the Gemara says, I think it's a Gemara in Tainis, it says, one Friday afternoon, Rav Chanina ben Doisa wanted to light Shabbos lights, and there was no olive oil. You know, they used to light, as some people still do, light with wicks in olive oil. And there was no oil. So, all there was some vinegar. So he said, it's no problem, bring the vinegar. So they brought the vinegar, and he lit the vinegar. So people obviously were standing around, must have said, oh, but you can't do that, vinegar doesn't burn. So he said, no, of course it does. Misha omer l'shemen v'yidlok, let he who said to the oil that it should burn, let him say to vinegar that it should burn. What did he mean? He meant this. You think that oil burns because it's a combustible. If you ask somebody in the modern age why oil burns, somebody who knows about it, give a wonderful explanation. It's a combustible mixture of hydrocarbons, you know, and he'll explain to you exactly why it burns. Why vinegar doesn't burn? It's impossible for vinegar to burn. It's not a combustible substance. But actually, that's completely wrong. That's completely wrong. Oil burns because Hashem wants it to burn. Obviously. Only the way you try to provide it with some sort of logical explanation is you describe it in that way. But obviously, everything in the world is only Hashem's existence. There is nothing that's real besides that. And therefore, the fact that oil burns at the highest level of understanding really is only because Hashem is revealing right now his desire that oil should burn. Vinegar doesn't burn because Hashem simply reveals his desire that vinegar doesn't burn, but it's all. But if you're on a level where it makes no difference to you, where you understand that oil is just an illusion anyway, that the reality over here is what Hashem intends, what Hashem wants, So then it doesn't make any difference to you whether oil does or doesn't burn, whether vinegar does or doesn't burn. All that you are in tune with is Hashem's desire. And in terms of Hashem's desire, obviously vinegar can burn just as easily as oil can. Therefore, if you're on a level where it makes no difference to you, so it makes no difference to Hashem either. Don't understand why. This is a slightly an aside, but first of all, just to get this clear, why is it that if a person realizes this so intensely, but of course you have to realize it so intensely that you're not impressed at all. That means when you light vinegar and it burns, you're not impressed at all. You're just you're every bit as impressed when oil burns. You think that you're seeing an amazing revelation of Hashem's will here. When oil burns, it's just as much a miracle to you as when vinegar burns. Every bit as much. If you have any reaction to vinegar burning at all, of course you're nowhere near this level. Now, why is it that someone on this level can do these kind of miracles? And by the way, the Gemara is full of them. In fact, there's a remarkable question in the mystical writings that deals with why the Talmudic period in Jewish history, is much more full of miracles than even the Tanakh period, which was a much greater level of spiritual greatness. But even the Talmudic period is full of Tanaim doing miracles. Rav Chanina ben Dosa lighting the vinegar, and I think it was Rav Chanina also put his foot over the hole of a poisonous, sort of a cobra, a very poisonous animal. And to show his students that animals don't kill, sin kills. Right? Put his foot over there to show that it had no effect on him. And in fact, I think, if I'm not mistaken, the Gemara says that if it bites a man, it depends who dies first, if whichever one gets to water first. And I think, anyway, the long and the short of it is that it bit him and died. Okay? It bit him and it died. You follow? This cobra bit him and the cobra died. That's what happened. He wants to show his students that it's not the physical world that does harm, it's your sin that does harm. And there are many examples. There are examples in the Gemara of people who revived the dead. Plenty of examples in Gemara times. We're talking just under 2,000 years ago. That means in the beginning, in the common era, in the history period that you read about a few centuries ago. There were people, the Gemara says quite clearly, examples, one of the lower level students, Talmidim, in Rebbe, Rebbe Yehuda Anasi's Beis Medrash. The Gemara says quite clearly that he was able to revive the dead. The example the Gemara gives, and the Gemara doesn't even tell it as a miracle. It just mentions it, by the way, because it's significant with regard to something else. It says that on one occasion, that Antoninus, the Roman Emperor Marcus Aurelius, he used to go and visit Rebbe. He used to visit him in a secret fashion, and want people to know. And because he didn't want people to know that he was visiting him and learning from him, he used to take two slaves with him, the Gemara says, when he arrived at the entrance to the secret tunnel that led into Rebbe's inner sort of place. He used to kill the one slave. And on his way back, when he reached his palace, he used to kill the other one. Slaves were expendable in Rome. He used to take them for an escort and kill them. What happened on one occasion was he killed a slave, and he went inside to speak to Rebbe, and he wasn't alone. Rebbe was there with one of his young students, one of the least of the students, or at least one of the students, one of the Talmidim in his base midrash. And when Marcus Aurelius, great Roman Emperor Antoninus, when he saw this man, he said to Rebbe, I told you I never want to be seen with anybody else. I want to be private and secret. So Rebbe tried to put him off as a Leistan Bar Inish, he isn't human, don't worry about him. But eventually, he couldn't put him off. So finally, the Roman, he said to the Talmud, don't call my slave in. He thought that would take him quite some time. He'd find a corpse outside, and he'd have to, you know, figure out how he's going to ask this corpse to step inside. So it says that the Talmud went outside, and in the passage he found the dead slave. So he had a dilemma, the Gemara says, because to schlep a corpse in is not a covet for a king. You follow? It's not an honor for a king, and you have to show respect to a king, even a non-Jewish king. On the other hand, not to obey the king is also not an honor. What was he going to do? So it says there wasn't much trouble. He davened, brought him back to life, and brought him in. So it says that when Antoninus saw it, he said to Rebbe that I'm not impressed at all, the Gemara says. I know that even the least in your school can do that. And there's many examples like that. The Gemara has cases of Marukva and his wife standing in a fire. You know, not to embarrass somebody, they went and hid in an oven. And many, many cases of miracles that happen. At the beck and call, as it were, of people who are on a great spiritual level. Now the way to understand this is as follows. The reason that a person can do a miracle and call on the miracle, demand that it happen, he can bring vinegar and light it, that doesn't mean Hashem is granting him a miracle. That means he's actually causing it to happen. The reason for that, and we discussed this on that occasion, just very briefly, the reason is this, that the whole of nature really is only a mask. That's what we understand. We understand that nature actually is a mask of Hashem. If it weren't for nature, you'd see Hashem directly. So what happens is he builds a world where there's a routine that happens all the time, and you get so used to it, you think that it's what you call natural. You don't realize that it's actually Hashem doing it all the time. Actually, there's no reason that a natural phenomenon is any less miraculous than an unnatural, just that you're used to the one, that's all. The other one you haven't seen yet. So you think it would be remarkable and amazing thing if it happened, but it's only because you haven't seen it. But the things you are used to seeing are every bit as wonderful, just that you're so accustomed to them that they don't move you anymore. But that's what Hashem does. In order to prevent your seeing the spiritual world so that you still operate within the realm of free choice, He hides the spiritual world with a world called nature. He makes it look so-called natural. Teva, the word teva in Hebrew, which means nature, really means to drown. Tove in Hebrew means to drown. It means you drown in an illusion of unreality. That's what it means. It has other meanings also. Therefore, nature is just a mask. Now, if a person's on a great enough level, what happens is, it's a fantastic thing to understand, a mask is only relevant to somebody who can't see through the mask. Think about it for a minute. Let's say you're sitting someplace and a friend of yours comes in a disguise. Yes? Wants to fool you, he can't see who this person is. So this person is teasing you and he's talking in a strange voice and he's wearing a disguise and you can't see who the person is. And he taunts you, right, because you can't identify the person. Let's say after a while you recognize who the person is. Is there any point to his wearing a disguise anymore? Obviously not. What fool would wear a disguise, hiding himself in front of somebody who knows who he is? Obviously, the only point in a mask is so that somebody can't see it. But if the person sees through the mask, no point. And that's exactly the way Hashem is. He puts a mask on for people who can't see through the mask. But for people who can see through the mask, he takes the mask off. What's the point of hiding himself in nature? You hear the beauty of it. What's the point of hiding himself behind nature in front of a man who sees through nature? If Chananel ben Doisa doesn't have him, he's not impressed at all by nature. It doesn't make any difference to him. To him, there's nothing natural about the world. To him, it makes absolutely no difference whether oil burns or vinegar burns. Not at all. So why should Hashem bother, you follow? Why does Hashem bother to continue making oil burn and not vinegar? The only reason He makes oil burn and not vinegar burn for you is so that you can end up thinking that there's some sort of natural law over here that's got its own reality. So you don't see Hashem. But if you see Hashem clearly, are we together? No. If you see Hashem clearly, then of course there's no need for Him to hide Himself anymore, and He takes off the mask. And if you're on that level, so then you can call on miracles. Because you don't need, there's nothing that's hidden from you anyway. And so if you use the world for the right purpose, you can use it for the right purpose as you see fit. Okay, that's the idea. That's the idea, it's a basic idea of how a person on that level is able to merit. Now the question that we have to ask, that's a very interesting discussion in its own right, but the question we have to ask is this. So why does he have to make any effort? You see, people on that level of greatness, you find that they also make natural effort in the world. They do make an effort in the world. They do things that seem natural. At least somewhat, somehow natural. That's a problem. If a man like that can take